This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In recent years, the minimum wage and whether to raise it has become a national issue. And here in New England, every state but New Hampshire has increased its rate above the federal level of $7.25 an hour. Maine's is just a bit higher at $7.50. Connecticut, Vermont, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts have raised their minimums more substantially, and several are planning future increases, with Massachusetts set to have the highest in the region at $11 an hour next year. While some claim this makes New Hampshire an unattractive outlier, others suggest it's in keeping with our philosophy that the government should stay out of businesses' business. Now several bills in the legislature take up this issue again, ranging from an immediate raise to $12 to a more gradual increase over several years. Today in The Exchange, gauging the minimum wage debate in New Hampshire. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We had three guests in the studio. Bob Sanders is here, staff writer for the New Hampshire Business Review. Bob, welcome back. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
Also with us, Representative Ed Butler, Democrat from Hart's location, sponsor of a bill that would raise the minimum wage gradually. Ed Butler is also the owner of the Notchland Inn in Hart's location. And Representative Butler, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Senator Andy Sanborn, Republican from Bedford, and owner of the Draft Sports Bar and Grill in Concord. And Senator Sanborn, welcome back.
Laura, thanks so much for having me on today.
Well, and to first, Bob, I think, how much attention is the minimum wage increase getting in the legislature this time around? This is not the first time that we've talked about this.
No, this is a perennial issue, like right to work. It comes up instead of the spring, it's in the winter when the legislature starts. I think it's gotten some more attention this year just because of the presidential debate, where on the Democratic side, it's a big issue between Sanders and Clinton. And so it's kind of a way to stake out things. And the other reason is because other people are doing it all around us. And that causes some pressure both on the activist side, the labor side, to push for it. It also causes some pressure on wages generally around the border. Since everybody else is going up, you want to keep your workers. So that causes a lot of interest in it because maybe less resistance by businesses, since they're going to have to pay their workers anyhow to keep up with the people around them. But there is always going to be resistance from business on a minimum wage. It's kind of a litmus test. It's kind of like the no new taxes. It's pretty hard line generally. But if there's in both sides, if there's less resistance on one side, maybe the other side has more of a chance.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the New England comparison. And by the way, if people want to check out the rates all around New England, we put a chart on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. But just so listeners have a sense of this, Connecticut is $9.60, Maine is $7.50, Massachusetts is $10, Vermont is $9.60, and Rhode Island is $9.60, and New Hampshire is at the federal minimum of $7.25. Bob, how do economists that you talk to see this? As you mentioned, it's a small region. Workers and businesses have some flexibility as where they choose to bring their labor or where they choose to set up shop.
Well, the ones I say it really is a wash. I mean, some people say it hurts, you know, employment, and other people says that it won't make any difference. Generally, the minimum wage, there's very few people making the minimum wage in New Hampshire. It's about 15,000 is what I saw, and that's about 4% of the workforce. But if you start talking about raising the minimum wage to 9, you're talking maybe about 70,000, I think. And then if you talk about 12, you're talking 140,000 because you have all those low-wage workers. But in addition to that, the increasing the minimum wage increases wages all through the bottom. It kind of trickles up because you start people at the minimum wage. It's kind of called a training wage by a lot of businesses. Well, if you start people at the minimum wage at $7.25, then, you know, they work their way up. They get 8 maybe. Well, now if you're starting your workers at 9, then you work your way up, they're getting 10 or 11 maybe.
So it pushes all levels up. And let's bring our two business owners into this, actually, both members of the legislature and people who hire people probably at the minimum wage. I'll turn to you first, Senator Sanborn. Looking at this from a New England perspective, is this a plus or a minus for our state to have the lowest wage in the region?
You know, Laura, I think what's really important in the conversation is not to talk about one section of the wages, but we need to talk more holistically about all of it. And I think this really highlights a real difference between the both political parties today and the narrative of where we are in it. As an independent Republican, as a business owner first probably, my number one concern is seeing every wage go up. And if we're being successful in all the efforts we've been trying to make as a Republican Party is to wage everyone's wages, just not one subset, which is what the Democrats are talking about. So as Bob had indicated, we need to break it down a little bit. 1.3 million people in our state, about 770,000 of them are actually working for a living. Of that, about 150,000 of those people are working in municipal government jobs. So we really have about 600,000 people working. The statistics we see show that about 76,000 people are making, let's say, quote, minimum wage today. But 71,000 of those people are actually in the hospitality industry where Representative Butler and I make our home and put our stake in our nest. And we know for a fact that industry, even though they're making, quote, minimum wage because they're servers and they're working in the hospitality, they get tips. So we don't really see them really making minimum wage in an effective basis because if they're good employees and they're operating well, they provide a good service to their employees and they make more than minimum. And I think on average, the average server makes between $10 and $17 an hour. So what we're left with is about 5,000 people in the state of New Hampshire that are truly making minimum wage. We know, or we have found absolutely no evidence in the past year that we've been having this conversation that any of them, not a single one of them, is a primary wage earner for their house. So who are they? They're kids in high school. They're people starting out. They're people trying to pick up a second job to earn a little extra money for Christmas. So in New Hampshire, I think we have a long, proud tradition of paying people fairly. In fact, I think if we look at the numbers that our average wages in New Hampshire are one of the highest in the country and our average success financially, again, one of the highest in the country. So globally, we are exceeding all of these standards we see and we hear people talk about when it comes to total wages. So I honestly think the system's working. I mean, look, minimum wage, as Bob had said, it's a training wage. For me to hire someone who's never worked at the restaurant or hire someone at one of my other entities to come and do work, to see how productive they are, to see if they can get the work done, to see if they can exceed and excel, and if they do, then they should get a raise.
And let's set aside the tipped employees for just a minute, because you're right, that's a whole other thing, how much those employees should make per hour. But Senator Sanborn, to you, so what do you think about what Bob Sanders said, that not that many people make the minimum wage, but if you raise the minimum wage for those folks, you have to raise everybody else's wage?
You know, it's interesting. There's been a number of articles, if people want to go, your listeners want to go online and look, that some people have actually contended that the drive to raise the minimum wage across the country hasn't been as much about raising wages for people who are making minimum, but we're seeing across the country that union contracts, not in the municipal sector, but in the public sector, are now beginning to tie all of their income to a multiplier on the minimum wage versus just what it is. So, you know, let's say you're in your work at General Motors and you're making, you know, $65 an hour putting cars together. where those contracts used to be $65 an hour and all the add-ons. Now they're saying, well, we want a multiplier of, you know, 10 times of what the minimum wage is. So many people are contending, you know, there's another real kind of hidden agenda or push to try and raise the minimum wage across the state. And I think it's something we should be aware of.
Representative Butler, describe your bill. You've said that you hope this can offer a middle way on the long debate over the minimum wage.
That's true. I think it is of the minimum wage bills that have been proposed over the past few years, one of the more moderate attempts. And I did it because in the last two minimum wage bills that came before the House, I couldn't vote for them. They were too much, too fast, too soon. And as a small business owner and as a member of a group in the Mount Washington Valley of independent restaurant owners called the Valley Originals, which is about 21, I think, independently owned restaurants, I know that we can't manage or sustain that kind of a large increase in the minimum wage over a short period of time. So I committed to myself and to my caucus that I would bring forward a minimum wage bill that I could support. And so my bill raises the minimum wage over 3 years to $9.50. It has nothing to do with union contracts. It was just an attempt to try to make as reasonable sense out of raising the minimum wage as possible. And I agree that this has little to do with the minimum wage, but I think it has a lot to do with low-wage earners. And in the testimony on my bill in the House, Jeff McLynch pointed out
with
that
– the Fiscal Policy Institute. Yeah.
Right, exactly. The minimum wage in 1979 could buy about $9.68 worth of goods in 2012 dollars, and now they can purchase just $7.25 worth of goods. The value of the dollar has – been reduced. And I'm sure that Andy sees it, and as do I. Are those people that we are paying, you know, less than $15 an hour are working hard to make ends meet. It's not – I don't believe that many of them can't find a way to make ends meet, but it's a struggle. And I think that it is reasonable to raise the minimum wage, in part to compete with our neighbors, in part to get ready for what is ultimately going to come at some point, I think, on a federal level, but also to help our small businesses move in a reasonable way towards managing an increase in the minimum wage that is more doable than other proposals.
How much would raising the minimum wage, Representative Butler, cost you as an employer? As Senator Sanborn says, when you raise the minimum, you have to bump everybody else up too. So how much would that cost you?
Well, in checking with other businesses in the Valley, there are very few that pay at the minimum level. And those who do pay at the minimum level are, as Senator Sanborn said, likely in the early stages of learning how to work and in a job that's going to move them into a better hourly pay. We don't pay at the inn anything close to the minimum wage. And we would have to see how raising the minimum wage would impact the overall economy and the competition in our area. I imagine that some of our lower paid workers would get bumped 25 or 50 cents an hour. And that's something that we could manage. We couldn't manage. We would have to reorganize how we do things if it was up to $12 or $15 an hour.
Which is what some of the Democratic presidential candidates are suggesting. Senator Sanborn, one of the broader sort of macroeconomic issues that people say New Hampshire is struggling with is slow wage growth nationally as well, and that if wages weren't so sluggish, people would be out there more at restaurants like yours, or they would be out buying clothes. And so that's the frustration that people have with this economic recovery, is that it hasn't been as quick as people had hoped, hasn't been as robust as people had hoped, because they say wages are stagnant. So people aren't out there buying, shopping, investing. What do you think about that? Maybe the minimum wage is the boost that this economy needs, according to that perspective.
I guess the question, Laura, is it the cart or is it the horse? So that's the real narrative about, do we just tell all companies they have to pay people more money, which would be kind of what the philosophy is, right, in a lot of this discussion. We're just going to raise how much you pay people, and then everyone will have a better day. But as business owners, and even it was great to hear Ed talk about the fact that we're in the same business, money doesn't grow on trees. And there's a requirement that employees have to generate some sort of revenue for the entity they work for. I mean, obviously, there's nonprofits that work on donations, but in the businesses that we're in a manufacturing business, in a sales business, people have to actually generate enough money for the entity to see them get paid. So just continuing to raise the minimum wage without allowing the entity to actually do more business makes that shrinking and tightness of the companies. And again, as Ed had said, even in his business and our business, there's only a threshold of how much cushion we have to spend more money on anything, be it wages or not. In a general philosophy, though, you're right. New Hampshire's not doing that well economically. Our wages are stuck. Our revenue is stuck. We're seeing so many other states across the country, and I think this is important. You know, when you look at North Dakota and what they're doing with fuel, and we look at Pennsylvania compared to New York, whether or not you like fracking, there's an economic element. We look at all the things Texas has done, and Texas has created more jobs than the rest of America combined, specifically. Cut taxes, cut regulation, allowed the free market to work, and people are flocking there. Here in New Hampshire, our biggest challenge, as you've talked about so many times in this show, arguably the highest healthcare costs in America, the second or third highest cost for electricity in America, one of the highest costs of real estate taxes in America, the second or third worst environment for business taxes in America.
So that's the way to get at it, you're saying. Not the minimum wage, but a more dynamic economic environment.
Yeah. I mean, here's the question. What are we doing to attract good-paying employers to come to New Hampshire? I mean, GE, I think, is a wonderful, although tragically sad, example that what does it take for one of the world's largest companies to uproot and leave Connecticut and move, of all places, to Massachusetts, who used to be like our sworn enemy economically.
And has the highest minimum wage in the region.
And has the highest minimum wage in the region, but is still a more attractive place globally for a business to locate to and operate out of. They didn't even think about coming to southern New Hampshire because we've become so unattractive in all the other reasons. So again, to me, minimum wages are incredibly important. We need to create the environment so all wages do better, but not just say we're just going to pay people more but have no idea where the money's coming from. So I applaud Ed on his recognition about the fact you can't just – you just can't throw the ball all the way down the field and expect everyone's going to run and get it.
Go ahead, Bob Sanders.
Yeah, I just wanted to put another layer of perspective here in terms of remaining competitive. New Hampshire has always prides itself for cross-border things. Like, we want to have the lowest sales taxes. We want to have that because we get all these people coming to the border. But it could work the other way, too. And I think there is some concern about this. When everybody's minimum wage and they're starting their wages, too, and we have figures on that, are starting to go up generally higher. Now, I'm talking about the lower end of the spectrum, not because obviously with our lack of income tax, we get these rich people coming to the border. They show our personal income, one of the best in the country. But when we're talking on the lower end, that working class and lower, less than $12 an hour, we are not competitive when it comes to wages. And those people, especially when you have a $3-4 differential, they're going to start crossing the border. If you're going to cross the border for a pack of cigarettes, wouldn't you cross the border for $3-4 an hour? And the question is, we have a labor shortage, especially in the southern area. And we're going to lose these. And who are we going to lose? Are we going to lose the people who are not very qualified, or we're going to lose the people who are, we're going to lose our best people who will go for the wage. Now, we have best people on the lower end of the scale, just as we have best people on the higher end. And
so why not hop over the border if you live there? Let me jump in on you, Bob, for a second. We'll pick up after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, to raise or not to raise the minimum wage in New Hampshire. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at the minimum wage debate in the Granite State, given several bills in the legislature addressing this. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. With us in studio, Bob Sanders, staff writer for the New Hampshire Business Review, Senator Andy Sanborn, Republican from Bedford, and owner of The Draft Sports Bar and Grill in Concord. Ed Butler is here too, state representative, a Democrat from Hart's location, sponsor of a bill that would raise the minimum wage gradually. Ed Butler is owner of the Notchland Inn in Hart's location. And Bob Sanders, I had to cut you off before the break there. I apologize. Go ahead and finish up your point. You were talking about the concern that New Hampshire has a labor shortage and that some folks who live along the New Hampshire border with Massachusetts or the New Hampshire border with Vermont might say, hey, I'll just drive a little bit longer and make a lot more money.
Yeah, it isn't totally there. I mean, it's not always easy to pick up and go. It's just whether the wage differential is enough. But the concern is that we might be losing some of our more qualified people, and businesses may not come here because our labor, not only we don't have enough qualified people because they're going to other states to make more money.
All right. Lots of people want to jump in, and I know you guys want to jump in as well. But let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Matt joins us from Merrimack. Hi, Matt. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say something about Senator Sanborn mentioned a couple of things. He said that the minimum wage was only for young workers, teenagers, and things like that. That's actually not true. Less than 25% of all minimum wage workers are below age 20, and the majority of workers are above that. I mean, considering that majority, 50% or so, are above the age of 25. I mean, you think about it, you work during the day, you're not going to see all these kids working at Dunkin' Donuts or all these low-wage jobs. Another thing is that you mentioned that tipped workers make much more than minimum wage. When you consider how many hours they work and what they bring in for tips, they typically only, in New Hampshire, average about $13,000 a year, which is actually less than a full-time minimum wage worker in throughout the year. So those are just a few of the things. Considering that as well, I wholeheartedly support raising the minimum wage. And if we raise the minimum wage, that'll also bring up the tipped minimum wage. And I know that you're going to have Jackie Philly on talking about her bill
Matt,
to
thank
eliminate
you for the call.
Tipped minimum wage.
Let's talk about, first of all, the teenagers. And first to you, Representative Butler, does your bill talk about a separate wage for teenage workers?
It does. One of the things that I've heard from some employers in our area, especially the ski mountains, is that they employ a lot of teens during the ski season, and that they have heard from parents and the kids themselves that it's a great opportunity to learn basic work skills, and that those employers are looking to continue to provide that service to the kids and to pay at the federal minimum wage. And there's also a training wage which would not be impacted. So my bill does have an amendment that would exempt kids under 18 from the raise in the minimum wage. Of course, it doesn't mean that you can't pay kids more. And I know that there are lots of places that pay their first-time workers more than the minimum wage.
Especially given the labor shortages that Bob Sanders talked
exactly.
about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it does also allow those businesses that feel that they need to have that $7.25 as the base for their teen workers to make that possible.
And Senator Sanborn, you know, with our caller, and we talked about this before, too, in the show, there's so much debate about who really makes this wage, whether it's someone looking to supplement their income, as you said, a teen or someone saving for Christmas, or whether it's someone who's, you know, trying to raise a family, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to very respectfully disagree with the caller on a point, and Representative Butler will agree with me on this. There is a, you know, it is against the law to pay people under minimum wage. And the law is very specific on tip servers that there's a requirement that if their tips and their wages don't exceed minimum wage, we have to kick in the difference. So
give us an example.
So let's say you have a server who, you know, if the server wage is $3.26 an hour and they work 10 hours, but they didn't bring any tips in whatsoever. They had no tables. They helped no one in the facility. So they actually only made that minimum $3.26 an hour. As an employer, I have to kick in the difference to get them to minimum wage, and all employers have to, Laura. Ed does, I do, everyone does.
So I didn't realize that. There's a snowstorm, it's a slow day, waitress isn't bringing in any tips.
Absolutely specific.
You have to bring her up to minimum wage.
Now, I've only owned a restaurant for 10 years, so I only have 10 years of experience, but I can tell you never in 10 years with 28 employees have I ever had to kick in money to an employee to get them to that minimum wage level.
Even with all those blizzards we had.
Even with all the blizzards.
Last year.
Well, fortunately for me, unlike Representative Butler, I'm downtown. So when there's a blizzard, there's less driving, more walking. So they're not driving up to my good friend's place up in the Notch. They're walking over to my place for a beer.
Well, they're already there when we've got a blizzard.
Yeah, there you go. And they're stuck and they're not going anywhere. Exactly. Well, while we're talking about tipped workers, thank you so much for the call, Matt. We have with us now State Representative Jackie Silley, a Democrat from Barrington. And she has proposed several wage-related bills this year, including one that would increase the minimum wage of tipped workers. And Representative Silley, it's nice to see you. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Thank you for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about your bill, specifically what it says about this issue of tipped workers.
Okay. I actually have two bills, but the one that deals with tipped workers would phase out the sub-minimum for tipped workers over a period of 4 years.
And what is that minimum for tipped workers now?
What's the minimum in New Hampshire, this is interesting because in 2012, the legislature eliminated our minimum wage entirely, so we're at the federal minimum. If we were at the federal with tipped workers, it would be $2.13. I mean, that's an embarrassing and has long-standing historical roots in places we don't want to go. But in New Hampshire, they failed to take it out of the RSA, so it's actually 40% of the federal. It's
$3.27. $3.27 for tipped
workers.
And
it's worth noting that the tipped wage actually has its roots all the way back to slavery.
So $3.27, but as Senator Sanborn describes, by law, he has to kick it up to at least the minimum of $7.25 if things are slow.
That's true. There are some questions about that in terms of how that's applied and whether all employers do it, but that is the law.
They're supposed to do that.
They are supposed to do that.
So what would your bill do?
My bill would raise the tipped – it would be one fair wage across all all occupations, including the hospitality industry. It makes no sense for one industry to be carved out. I mean, you know, my husband and I own a horseshoe supply company. Why can't we have our clerks or our drivers work on tips? You know, why can't we say there's a tip jar in the, you know, in the vehicle, and anything that, that a customer receives in terms of the service, they would tip for that.
What have you heard, Representative Silley, from those workers who would be most affected by this, the waitresses and waiters of New Hampshire?
They are gathering. We're hearing more and more. There is an effort to organize, as there have been in other states. It's worth noting that in seven states, they've eliminated the tipped sub-minimum wage entirely.
In seven states?
In seven states. And those states, we don't have to guess. We don't have to theorize about what might happen. We know what's happening on the ground. Their hospitality sector is doing far better. Their growth rate is about 10.8 as opposed to 9.1 in states that have not done this. You take Washington, that has been extremely aggressive about pushing up their wage floor entirely, both tipped and minimum wage workers. Their hospitality sector is extremely robust. They've had only 1 year back in the late 1990s where they've lost any growth in that industry, and there were other reasons for it. They have continued to outpace the country. Their servers, interestingly enough, get about 27%, even though they're making, an $11 an hour wage. Their tipped workers actually make 27% on top of that. If you go to Alabama, that has the lowest minimum and sub-minimum wage in the country, their tipped workers make about 14%.
So is there a concern, Representative Silley, that waiter, waitress wages overall would go down because people will say, well, you're making, you know, a good salary, so we don't need to tip you anymore.
Not at all. And in the seven states that have eliminated the sub-minimum, we can see what's happening with tipped workers. They are actually doing far better, and they have a salary that they can count on. So they don't have to worry that they're not going to make the rent. We have about 25,000 tipped workers in the state of New Hampshire. The hospitality industry actually employs about 60,700, according to the NRA, National Restaurant Association. And about 25,000 of them would fall into the group that we're looking at very carefully. They are twice as likely to live in poverty. They are twice as likely to need public assistance. We could save about $8.7 million in the state of New Hampshire alone just by raising their wages.
In some European countries, the tip, as you know, Representative Silley, is considered included in the price. And if you don't tip, you're not expected to tip. If you put a spare euro on the table, you know, that's fine, but it's absolutely not expected or required. Why do you think the culture here wouldn't eventually follow the same path where people say, you know, that waitress is making $8, $9, $10 an hour, so I don't need to leave her a tip?
It just has not happened in the seven states that have eliminated the sub-minimum wage. And again, I think what's interesting about this, if you talk to customers, I did a radio show last week, and even the host was absolutely shocked to learn that what they leave a server is not a gratuity. Most of us believe that that's a
thank you for good service.
A thank you for good service. We're actually paying their wages. And
making up the gap.
When each individual customer pays the wages of a tipped worker, that has all kinds of implications. For example, about 7% of the population is actually in a tipped wage profession. 37% of sexual harassment complaints come out of that industry. You're going to tell somebody who's inappropriate to you that you know you're relying on for part of your salary? That was an inappropriate gesture. I mean, we see this all the time. It has a whole host of, very, very bad implications for workers.
Representative Butler, what do you think about this? What does your bill say about tipped workers? As I understand, it's got a different take than Representative Silley's.
It certainly does. But it doesn't essentially deal with tipped wages much differently than what we do now. It defines the hourly for the tipped worker. So it would raise it to $4 in the second year and $5 in the third. But it still, as Senator Sanborn said, would require that if that person, that server, did not make the minimum wage, that the minimum wage would be required to be paid. But the minimum wage workers in this state, depending on whether you talk to Bob or you talk to those in the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association, make somewhere between $12 and $17 or more dollars an hour when you look at the money that they take home. And so it seems disingenuous to me to be focusing on a segment of the population that is making significantly more than the minimum wage. What we need to be doing is increasing the minimum wage for those low-wage workers who are having the hardest time to survive. If we're going to change the culture of tipping, that's going to take time. And I'm glad that there are seven states that are beginning to work on it. But they're beginning to work on it because they're raising tipped wage up to the minimum wage. They're not talking about, as in Seattle, getting rid of the tips entirely and paying $15 an hour, which has had some very mixed reviews in the first year. So I think the tipped wage, I work with servers. I know lots of people who work in that industry through the Valley Originals, and just because our economy in the Mount Washington Valley is so focused on hospitality. But many tipped wage work earners are not interested at all in changing the way things work because they're making a decent living.
Okay, Senator Sanborn, to you, and then Representative Silley, a couple more questions
awesome.
For you.
So, you know, two points on this. The first, same thing. I've actually polled my employees and said, hey, look, let's have this discussion. We meet every single week. I really believe in the inclusivity of being an employer. Not a single employee that we have ever asked, should we get rid of your capacity to get tips and go to a fixed level of income for you? Not one ever has said, gee, I want to make some fixed dollar an hour because maybe I'm very fortunate that I hire people that are go-getters and active and they're great salespeople. And that's the second point, is this is an industry where servers and those in the tipped environment really recognize if they work hard, if they provide great service, they don't get 10 or 15% tips. I see sometimes 30 and 50% tips with great notes, phenomenal service, you did a great job. I also kind of liken it to actually had a bunch of realtors in my restaurant last week, and we were talking specifically about this issue, and they raised a great point. One of them turned to me, who's on the board of New Hampshire Realtors, and said, "Hey, Andy, I don't make any money. I make zero. I don't even get minimum wage. I have to go out there and earn it every day, and quite frankly, I'd have it no other way."
He's working on commission.
Working on commission. So you think about car salesmen, you think about realtors, you think about mortgage bankers, you think about all these other professions where people don't get any minimum wage at all, and they like it like that because they want to work hard, and quite frankly, they tend to do very well financially.
Bob Sanders, real quick.
Quick is that just a little figures here. According to the census, tip workers made $9.39 an hour in New Hampshire, which is below every state except Maine. And that includes tips, according to the census. The $13,000 that was thrown out earlier, it's a yearly salary, but a lot of tip workers are part-time. So that explains this differential. But they aren't making 15, you know, 20. There are some that are, obviously, and a lot of people like to think they are because it's like a gambler. Oh, yeah, I'm doing great. You know, they don't want to – they remember when they won. They don't remember when they lost. They remember those great nights when they got those great tips. But a lot of people don't remember those nights when it was pretty slow.
Well,
quickly, that number that Bob is reporting is recorded tips. And lots of tips are not recorded.
Okay. And the averages on these are tough because somebody might get tips working at Pizza Hut and somebody might get tips working at, you know, the Chop House in Manchester. So, Representative Silley, I want you to have the last word here.
Well, there are a couple of things that I'd like to push back a little bit on. You know, first of all, Andy's talking about independent contract workers, essentially, or self-employed people when you say a realtor doesn't make that much. When you talk to your workers about lifting the, you know, getting to a livable wage and taking away tips, that's not what we're talking about. This is raising the sub-minimum, and it is not disallowing tipping in any form. And we see that both in Europe and Canada and other places, people still leave what they consider a gratuity. They realize they're not paying somebody's salary. And I want to get back to a point that Bob made about our workers going, you know, to other states. We have about 20% of those 600,000 workers that are actually working out of state. It is putting tremendous pressure on our ability to hold on to skilled workers. And then lastly, I'd like to say this whole business of this is a training wage and these are teens, you were quite right, Bob, when you said, you know, less than 20, it's actually about 24%, or I think the caller said about 24% were below the age of 20. More than half, 51%, are over the age of 25. I defy anybody to go out there to a restaurant and take a good look at the server because you're more inclined to find a middle-aged woman, somebody who probably has children, and about 25% of them have their single moms. And, you know, my sister, who's recently married, was exactly that not so long ago in her 50s, having spent now decades as a server. And I can tell you, she's engaging. She does a great job. The restaurant she works for loves her. But over time, because she's no longer one of those cute little bunnies, the tips have changed accordingly. And that's, you know, that's part of the problem here.
Well, lots to think about. Representative Silley, thank you so much
for
coming
in.
We really appreciate it. That's State Representative Jackie Silley, a Democrat from Barrington, talking about her bill that would increase the minimum wage of tipped workers. Our conversation about the minimum wage overall continues in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, more on the minimum wage discussion underway in New Hampshire's legislature. We're looking at some of the bills and proposals. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Should New Hampshire raise the minimum wage or not? What do you think? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And by the way, for a quick comparison of minimum wages in New England, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Again, the number for you to join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. 892-6477. And here's an email that came in from Rob, who says the jobs that are tagged as minimum wage jobs were never intended as careers. Fast food jobs are for teenagers, first jobs, and the elderly that want to supplement their retirement. Arbitrarily raising the wage for a fast food worker is just eventually going to raise overall wages and eventually lead to inflation. Rob says, let's instead invest that money in job training programs so we can stop thinking we can make careers of flipping burgers and thinking we need to force a $15 wage to do that job. Rob, thank you for the email. Bob Sanders, what is the connection between higher minimum wages and inflation? If a minimum wage represents an increased cost, in this instance labor, does it bump up costs for everything else?
I imagine it does. I don't know the exact figures, but the question is, if it bumps up things, does it bump it up more than what these workers will gain with the minimum wage? And that's, in other words, there's some drawbacks, and there's some. It might hurt people at higher wages more than it would hurt people at lower wages, because people at higher wages don't get the bump up of their
as much
own,
of a bump up
of their own wages. It will increase. It will increase spending, and that would increase the economy, and that would probably push inflation. The question is how much, and what. There's other factors with inflation too. Price of gas has gone down so much, so that would offset that.
At our forum with Hillary Clinton, one of our audience members asked Mrs. Clinton how she would raise the minimum wage without creating inflation. So, Ed Butler, it's a concern that if you do increase the price of labor, the price of everything else is going to go up with that. Now, Secretary Clinton said under her approach, the increase would be gradual. And in her mind, inflation was very low overall. There was room to absorb this. But I wonder what you think.
I think that comment from the Secretary of State seems right to me, and is one of the reasons that I have proposed this minimum wage bill, because it is gradual. Senator Sanborn said that doing this minimum wage increase of any kind would be putting the cart before the horse. And rather than that analogy, I think we ought to be looking at belt and suspenders. The caller or the person who sent that email said that we should be putting energy into programs that help create jobs and teach the workforce. And I think that's true. And I think that the state understands that and is putting as much effort and money into economic development and into job force training as possible. But it also doesn't mean that we can't do both, that we can't slowly raise the minimum wage to help low-wage earners and to do all the efforts at economic development that need to be done.
Rob, thanks for the email. Senator Sanborn, does a higher minimum wage create higher inflation?
Unequivocally, it does, Laura. Let's think about this. Today, a business can only charge so much for a gallon of milk. They can only charge – well, gasoline's a little bit different because of the way the market works. But we can only charge so much for a beer or a hamburger or a rake. And if we're forcing up the cost of business, right, if we raise minimum wage so the business has higher expenses, it needs to pass that along to the consumer. So you're going to see prices for what they sell have to go up as well. And I think one of the most recent reports I saw is that if you raise minimum wage by 10%, so from, let's say, from $7.25, we add 75 cents to it an hour, they're seeing an increase of total cost of product at the retail level go up 4%. So that's just at a 10% increase of the minimum wage in order to get all the other expenses and trickle down. So how much, how fast is the question? If they're going to double the minimum wage, not just 10%, Representative Butler has a much more reasonable plan, but you're going to see dramatic increases in the cost of product. So it's going to be more expensive. And in a sense, you've actually move the argument backwards, because now things are that much more expensive. You're actually further behind.
Let's take another call. This is Philip in Bath. Hi, Philip. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call. Well, first, before I make my comment, I'd like to dispute that emailer saying that service jobs are only, supposed to be for teenagers and retirees. I don't believe that there's enough 16 to 18 year olds or retirees in the country to fill all the service jobs that are out there. And, you know, it used to be you could get a high school diploma and go get a job and make a living wage. And a lot of those jobs, which are manufacturing, have disappeared, or now you need more education to get them. So that leaves the service job for people with a high school diploma or less. So you've got a whole group of people that's the job that they need to make a living on. And if you don't have a living wage, and this is where my point comes in, is that now they're relying on public assistance to be able to get by. So that means my taxes are supplementing Walmart. It's supplementing all the food chains because they're not paying a living wage, so I have to make up for it.
So, yeah, you're subsidizing the businesses that are paying low wages. You know, Philip, we have an email, Stacy from Concord, who also makes that point. She says, wouldn't taxes be lower if the minimum wage was higher, say $10 an hour? The need for state services would be lower because people would be making more money and would qualify for less. Stacy says she agrees with you, Philip. It seems that businesses who pay low wages expect the government to, quote, subsidize their employees' pay. Senator Sanborn, this has come up. Some economists have looked at this as to whether businesses are getting subsidies from government because their workers are paid so low they can't, you know, they need public services, food stamps, et cetera. What do you think?
I think, honestly, the only businesses that are getting subsidies are the big, huge, successful ones that can hire lawyers and lobbyists to go to either the State House of Washington, D.C. to get all these subsidies with these grants. I mean, the small everyday businesses, they don't have any capacity to go get grants and go get money from government. So on that argument, I would tend to respectfully disagree. We also have to remember that most, if not all, Representative Butler might need to help me on this, most, if not every single benefit and subsidy or program that the state has to help people who don't have a lot of money are for people who make under the minimum wage. Even if we look at the Affordable Care Act, even if we look at Medicaid expansion, all of them are tied to, you know, 100% or more of the minimum wage. So I don't see a lot of programs out there that if you're making what is minimum today where the government steps in and provides a subsidy to the business. It's an argument I respectfully just disagree with.
Well, it's not so much a subsidy to the business, but if I'm making a very low wage and I just can't feed my kids because I'm making so little, you know, I need food stamps or I need heating assistance or I need, you know, transportation assistance. So it's those types of individual grants that I'm pulling from because my employer isn't paying me enough. I think that's the idea.
Well, is my employer not paying me enough, or am I not going out there and working hard enough to try and bring the money home for myself? And I guess that's part of that argument on, you know, is it the employer's responsibility to pay someone more if they're not producing some sort of a result for the entity just because they want more money? Or is there also a co-responsibility of the employee to be a good employee and to be productive for themselves and their entity and justify that higher raise? It's an interesting question.
Do you want to jump in, Representative Butler?
I think the person who raised this issue, or the two people who raised this issue, are right that there are people who are making a low wage and possibly are working only part-time because they have kids or because they have a challenge in their life in a different way. I think we see those people struggling in several of our low-wage paying businesses. And I think that it's reasonable to consider raising the minimum wage in order to help move that that curve a little way towards helping. I think it would be interesting to see in those other states that are having higher minimum wages whether or not there is a decrease in the need for support from the state.
Bob?
Yeah, there's a minimum wage, even full-time, you're going to get some benefits. But a lot of people aren't full-time, and it isn't just because of a matter of choice. I mean, with just-in-time scheduling in both retail and hospitality especially, I have kids, and they never get full-time hours, and they're never sure what their hours are. One works in grocery, one works in hospitality, and one in retail. And it's, you know, they find out what their hours are 2 weeks in ahead or sometimes 1 week, and they schedule their life around that. And So they're
underemployed.
Yes, the thing is that the wages is just one issue. A lot of for now, a lot of the things is hour. How many hours are they going to get? Now, some people can get full time hours, and some people can't. So it depends on the business and so forth. But a lot of large businesses go. They want to keep their workers part time for several reasons. One is they don't have to pay the benefits, not just the Affordable Care Act. That's just one more. But there are a lot of benefits that are mandated if you go full time or even more than 30 hours nowadays. So you keep your costs down. You don't have as many full time workers.
Do you want to jump in, Senator Sanborn, and then back to our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this
but
is
the hours is an issue.
The hours is an issue. But again, perfect example of how the hand of government intruding into the business environment is having real negative effects. And the best highlight we have for that today, Laura, is the Affordable Care Act. And with the requirements of when you have to start paying that benefit of health insurance, which some companies cannot afford. So they did exactly what Bob talked about. They cut hours. So now we're seeing that as a result of government's intrusion into how it all operates, employers can no longer afford to give people all the hours they want. It's become a real disincentive.
I'm sorry. We have employees who couldn't have benefits before the ACA and who now have health care coverage because they can afford it.
Okay. And that's a whole other show, which we've done a million shows on the Affordable Care Act, and we'll continue to do so. But for now, we'll set that aside. Let's go to Danbury. Tom's waiting there. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, Tom.
I'm just curious about how the New Hampshire tax situation influences all this, because people here pay no income tax, whereas across the border we do. And this, I've worked in mass living in New Hampshire, and it certainly affected my total wage. And I'm wondering if this is a factor in minimum wages as well, if you're doing cross-border employment.
Well, it's a good point, Tom. And Bob Sanders, he's right. Massachusetts, we talked about why wouldn't people go to Massachusetts if they lived on the border, because the minimum wage is $3 higher practically there. But he's saying, yeah, you still have to pay that income tax in Massachusetts.
Yeah, but not $3 much. And the other
5%,
thing is,
I think.
Yeah, and the other difference is that when you go to Massachusetts, it's you got the first $10,000 or so of your wages are not taxed. So for the low-wage worker, that's even less of an argument. Now, it is true that the taxes get taken out and it's a psychological barrier. But in terms of money, if you're looking at the bottom line, it's certainly worth it to cross the border. There are other reasons, transportation, childcare reasons, one just being comfortable working closer to home for other reasons. But the taxes aren't a major disincentive compared to the wages.
Okay, and thank you for that call, Tom. Here's a couple emails that have come in. Peter says, I am a border hopper who lives in Maine and works in New Hampshire, and I completely agree that increasing the minimum wage would not be beneficial and could, in fact, be harmful. And Peter says, for the record, I make less than $9 an hour. Peter, thank you for that one. And then on the other side, we've got Nicole in Madison, who says, expanding and strengthening the middle class means businesses grow. Trickle-down economics needs to go. It doesn't work. Never has, never will. She says, as an example, Seattle is about to have a $15 an hour minimum wage, and their economy is thriving. Representative Butler, what are we learning from these other cities and states that have raised their minimum wages, in the Seattle example, by a lot?
Well, and in Seattle, it depends on which side of the aisle you are looking at the issue from. Because I did just quick research in the past couple of days, and there are some that are saying that as many as 700 jobs have been lost because of the increase, and there are others that are saying that the applications for restaurant businesses and licenses has increased since the raise to the $15. So I think it's only been, a little a year now, and I think the jury is still out.
Well, and we started off the show talking about Representative Butler's bill, Senator Sanborn, and how he's hoping that this sort of gradual approach, this less than $12 an hour approach, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's $9.60, is that what you hope to?
$9.50,
okay. That this could be a middle ground, that maybe Republicans could jump onto this? What do you think?
I think it's important for all the listeners out there, because I know how widespread your audience is, to go online and do a search to look specifically for automated ordering. And you're going to start seeing all these pictures. And in fact, even in my restaurant, we're beginning to have the conversation. And for me, it started about trying to make my company more efficient, trying to save some money, to give all my employees an iPad so they could go to your table and take the order right away while they stand there. It goes automatically down. Then the conversation quickly turned into, well, maybe we just need to bolt an iPad to every table so when someone wants to reorder a beer, they can just press it without a server.
Oh, without having to track down the waiter or waitress.
So now we're seeing online, and it's actually being implemented across the world, the fact that you're going into McDonald's and Burger King's and all of these businesses. You can go to airports. Several airports already have this. No need for a server. There's just an iPad. You scroll. You look at pictures on the menu. You press order. And then someone brings it to your desk. This is, I think, a very important part of this issue. We've seen automation at the upper wage level. So when you think about, again, the car manufacturers that, you know, where they're paying people $45, $55, $65, $75 an hour to build cars, it reached a financial threshold where the burden was so high, you saw automation come in and replace those workers. At the lower wage scale, with all these conversations, you know, at minimum wage, maybe not enough of an argument. You tell someone they've got to make $15 an hour. You're going to see businesses, in order to survive, begin to say, look, we need to find a way to stay in business and to do business. So we're going to start replacing employees with machines. And I think
what about 960? 15 it's a great, is I mean, a lot, but what about 960?
I don't know what the number is, in all honesty. I think it'll be different for every business. But we're clearly seeing today a movement of that risk that if employees become too expensive, then it becomes worthwhile to find other ways to replace them. And I'd hate to see that happen. It's wrong for every single reason. But you can only force so much weight on top of a business before it needs to start making some other types of decisions.
All right. We have to wrap it all up there. I think we'll be talking about this again before the legislative season is out. Thank you all so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your
time.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Dana Rosinski-Larson. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.